Well, it is a great pleasure this week to interview Kate Heffner. And Kate, I think we've known each other for a couple of years because, of course, you're doing your PhD in the history department here at the University of Kent.
Yep, I sure am. I think we first met at the Gulbenkian with Paul March Russell.
The second person I interviewed.
Yeah. Oh, Paul is just, he's such an amazing, mentor in person.
Yeah. And do you want to say a little bit about what you're studying for your doctorate?
For sure. Yeah. So I am a student in the history department. I am doing my thesis on women in science fiction fandom, which is a really emotional, embodied, and strange sort of thing to get do one's dissertation on. So I look at women in the post-war era, so after World War II, who engaged in creating science fiction fan magazines, colloquially referred to as fanzines. And these women produced their little fan magazines in response to some of the literature and movies and media in the science fiction genre. Yeah. So
that sounds like a dream project. It sounds like something that I'm going to guess, without preempting what you tell me about your own life, but that sounds like something that before you came to Kent was something that you always really wanted to either study or indeed practice in and disseminate in whatever way.
For sure. It is a little bit untraditional where, you know, some of my colleagues in the School of History, like, they study war and tanks and other stuff. For me, I'm really interested in, like, Star Trek and the history of literature, specifically to science fiction. So I am myself kind of a fangirl. So, yeah.
Do you know, I was thinking that because I interviewed many years ago Mark Connolly in the history department.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had a really good chat because Mark has like twin interests. There's the Christmas element, which is completely chimes with what I do with all the nostalgia. Right. And I wrote a book on Christmas. But his war stuff doesn't connect with me. That's not my thing whatsoever.
Right.
But he did say something to me, which was about diaries. Like, we all know what the generals were doing and the politicians were doing at the time of the Great War, but what about, and he gave a specific example of a housewife in a Lancashire mill town, this is like a random example, but if she'd kept a diary, would what she'd written around the time of the war have coincided with what was going on in the news, the official narrative, in inverted commas? And of course, inevitably, it almost certainly wouldn't have done. That's interesting because what you just indicated about your work with fandom is that it's very much about this kind of turn to the self, the sort of way that our own fandoms define us, and which are far more important than sort of studying, you know, Star Trek per se. Great that that is to do. It's more about the impact of Star Trek on the audience.
Yeah. That was so eloquently spoken. Can you do my Viva for me? Just joking. Yeah. I do care about the communities, and I have a definite connection to these sort of communities. It's almost as if it's a imagined ancestry where these women come from different parts. So in England and in America, they wrote about their relationship to domestic technologies in a time where, you know, major media productions were demonstrating these, were producing these images of dishwashers that would, you know, liberate women, cookers and other sorts of like domestic appliances that were basically created to liberate women. And in many ways, that didn't necessarily happen. Ruth Cohen, a historian of science, has written a lot about that. So for my work, I look at like women in science fiction fandom who are already interested in the ways that science and literature coalesce and can be combined and create sort of a resistant imaginary to the corporate structures of buy this refrigerator, your life's going to be wonderful. It's different in different, you know, contexts. So thinking through like austerity, thinking through the United States, how, you know, there was so much capitalism and growth as compared to the English struggle. So it's been a really fascinating exploration to see how women went through and created these resistant imaginaries.
Yeah. Because I've been to conferences, fandom comes up quite a bit in my own area, and I've had female academics talking about Star Trek, for example. But thinking about it, these programs, and particularly going back to the 1960s incarnation, were very male, very masculine sort of driven. The characters overwhelmingly male, and the writers male. Do you find that there are spaces for women's narratives to fit in here? Is there a lot of work in this kind of area that's specifically feminist or female-oriented?
Yeah, so the way that I historically situate the beginning of fandom is comes from 1926 with Hugo Gernsback producing or publishing Amazing Stories, a pulp magazine. And in one of his early issues, he calls for people to write in letters to sort of dictate this emerging thing in literature called scientifiction, right? So it wasn't even called science fiction. It's called scientifiction. Then Hugo Gernsback, collects the letters. He publishes them in the pulp magazine. He includes addresses. So readers who were fans read through the pulp magazine, saw, different critiques, reached out to other folks, and began to republish the letters that they sent from one another. And they compiled them into a little magazine. It was called a letter call, is what they called them. A letter column zine, but they called it a letter call. And then in 1930, you have a group of science enthusiasts create a fanzine called The Comet. This is produced by Ray Palmer, who later goes on to be a big science fiction editor and causes some controversy with some of his comments on science and imagination. And The Comet is basically a group for science fiction enthusiasts to write about what, like trends in science, but also to critique about literature as well. So then you have fan magazines that are being produced. How are they being produced? They're being produced in a really intimate and labored way. One of the ways that they did this was, again, science fiction fan cultures were somewhat of a younger group. So you're looking at young adults. The fans would go into the kitchen while their folks are sleeping, extract all the materials to make something called a hectograph, which is gelatin powder, glycerin, water. And they would construct a big jelly mold and print their works on a piece of paper with a very special hectograph pencil. Lay it on top of the mold so that the mold would be imprinted with this ink, and then lift up the print, and then take a piece of paper and pile it on top and print it out that way. So it's a very labor-intensive, messy way to do a DIY style of printing.
Yeah, and I'm just sort of thinking as you're talking about all of this, because I'm guessing that when you were studying in a school, or even maybe in your first degree, and we can talk about that in a minute, that these sort of interests were, they may have sort of been shaped by that, but it sounds like you're tapping into something that seems very sort of bespoke. It doesn't sound as though that's something that you would ever have been taught. I can imagine that you teach this to your own students. I know you do some teaching, and I bet they love what you're doing. But it sounds to me that what you're doing is something that just seems a world apart from the sort of opportunities, the sort of topics, the kind of more traditional sort of, certainly in the UK, the sort of education that I had. I don't regret anything that I did at university, but the sort of stuff that you're outlining now just sounds so amazing. And it's sort of like going to those sort of places where you simply don't get those, should we say, those official narratives, that you're doing something that you've obviously spent a lot of time cultivating and doing a lot of background research on and personal experience of.
Yeah, I think that the printing process, the early fan cultures, to me, it matters deeply to me, because you have a lot of great authors that come out of this tradition. You have Ray Bradbury. You have pop, you know, big name editors. You have science fiction authors like Judith Merrill in like the later post-war period, who uses a mimeograph to produce their fanzines. So there are a lot of folks who create fanzines who carried on this tradition, you know, into the 70s and 80s and 90s and still today. I like to study it. Maybe it's like a radical, rebellious form of book history. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll try and unpack some of that, because I'd love to know a bit about where the journey started for you, because obviously you're here in, and you obviously came all the way to the UK to do this wonderful doctorate. But we can unpack all of that. Do you want to say a little bit about your background and where you were born?
Yeah. So I was born in raised in Long Beach, California. So I'm a West Coast girl. I always joke with folks here that the Beach Boys wrote a song about me. I wish they all could be California girls. Not really. And I lived there for quite a bit. So I grew up in Long Beach. And then I moved to Iowa, to the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did my bachelor's and my master's in library information science there. And in perhaps a science fictional turn of events, I found myself at Kent.
Yes. See, I've just seen the new Indiana Jones movie.
Okay.
And The Dial of Destiny. And that's got a lot. Everything that you were describing, and I guess you haven't seen it yet. Maybe by the time this interview goes out, you will have done.
Okay.
And many of those listening to this will have seen it as well. But I love the way you say that the science fiction turn of events, because I'm completely sort of, you know, anything you tell me now, I will buy into. Indiana Jones has sanctioned that sort of way of looking at things. Oh. But I'd love to hear a bit more about what that science fiction turn of events was.
So when I was an undergraduate, I was really fascinated about academic culture. I'm a first generation college student. I worked all my way through my undergraduate. I was a cleaner at an elementary school, and I took a full load of classes in English lit. And I entered that space just feeling so alien, where it's like, okay, this is like an academic space. Mm-hmm. Like there's office hours, you know, it's a very othering space. So I felt sort of like an ethnographer in mm-hmm. a sense. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at different ways of how the Academy works and what have you. And I saw something that said CFP, and I was like, okay, what's a call for papers? Oh, you send out an abstract, you know, and then you deliver a paper. And, you know, so I kind of had an idea. So I sent out an abstract to a conference at the University of Liverpool just to see what a rejection letter looked like. That was literally it. I just wanted to see what, you know, is it going to be, will there be a masthead? Will there be, you know? And then about a few months later, it's like, congratulations, like, you're accepted to this conference. We want you to come and present. I was like, oh my gosh, okay, I guess I'm... So I got a passport, which I didn't have before, prepared my materials, begged, borrowed, and stole from the university in any way, asked departments for funding. I got some funding from folks, did a GoFundMe to cover the rest. And then I went to the University of Liverpool and delivered a paper. I met two amazing scholars, Dr. Sam Robinson and Dr. Amy Chambers. And they said, you know, you should consider doing a PhD in England. So I was like, cool, that sounds really hard and weird, but I'll consider it. Went back to the States. I finished my bachelor's degree. I got a degree in library and information science, which I'm very passionate about. And during the last year of my library information science degree, Sam and Amy were running a conference, and they gave me a bursary and invited me to present at the conference that they were running. And I presented a paper. And then in the crowd was this person named Professor Charlotte Slay. And Dr. Slay came to me and said, would you like to do a PhD with me at Kent? And yeah, so that was it. So I'm, that's, yeah.
It's funny because you must, you know, looking back, it sounds as though that would never, you know, the sort of almost the accidental coincidence. You happen to see this call for papers and then you come over and then, you know, asked to do a PhD. So you literally, you know, with the passport that you didn't have, you now, you know, travel, you know, around the world in order to do this. It does sound a bit like Harrison Ford, actually. Sort of, you know, but I'm interested in this because it sounds as though you're sort of doing a project that you love. And it sounds as though there are all these sort of doors opening, but your first degree was in what? I know you, your master's was in sort of library information. What was your first degree in?
English literature. Yeah.
Okay. Could you have imagined this journey?
That's a really good question. Yes and no. Like, no, because like first generation college student getting, you know, getting a degree, like is there's always like a set of challenges and struggles that are there. For folks who don't come from like, don't have the privilege of, you know, having like that academic background or that cult understanding of like cultural capital and the finances, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, in the way where it's like, of course, I'm going to do three kind of different degrees that are chaotic. Because it's my life, you know?
It's a curious sort of thing, but it sounds as though you're also setting markers. I don't know if you feel that. Maybe it's one of those sort of things. Maybe I'm hearing you speak and I'm, you know, looking at it from a more detached sort of position. But it sounds like you're doing something that's genuinely really very different.
Yeah.
Because everything that you're describing to me and the fact that Charlotte was in the audience and she asked you to do a PhD with her shows this wasn't a run-of-the-mill sort of, oh, you want to do some fandom stuff, which, you know, many other people do and do very well. But it sounds like you're doing something which seems to be game-changing in terms of the discipline. Has anyone said that to you before?
Oh, yes. I have heard compliments like that. Thank you. And ew, not, no, thank you. So much of my work is founded on community archives where a lot of the fan materials are housed. Charlotte Slay herself has produced a few publications on science fiction fandom and science, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to come here. And work under her. And there are different interesting ways of opening up fan studies. And there are a lot of really great, amazing fandom and science fiction scholars that have laid the foundation for me to kind of do what I do. So I'm so appreciative of that.
Because I always find that, and it's something that's come up with my own work, when I was a student, going back 30 years, you know, if I was writing an essay, it would always be, who are the important scholars? Who are the people who are writing the books that get published? And of course, and at that time, that's perfectly fine because you have to have a way into something. And of course, when you write an essay and you're churning them out every couple of weeks, you have to have some sort of sense of, you know, I'll go to the most important people, however that's defined. And of course, looking back, yes, they're often male, Eurocentric, white, you know, there's all those sort of things that you think now, you know, we'd think twice about that now. But, you know, go to the reputable publishers, whatever it is, and then that would be the sort of, you know, the way in. Look at the primary sources, look at the secondary sources, that's all great. But I think my own work, not least in looking at nostalgia, has made me look at things through a very different lens, because there are people who are not necessarily published, or they might be published people, academics, but the things they want to talk about are not the sort of things that you would expect to find in the words on those books in the shelves in the library that I would go as my main resource as a undergraduate student all those decades ago. So something has kind of shifted, because there was once upon a time that, you know, if somebody publishes something, they're an expert. But now we're thinking, well, hang on, because that's almost the sort of idea that we're only writing about and for elites. And often those elites are gendered, and there's all sorts of demographic and racial diversity issues and gender issues, which kind sexuality issues, which sometimes are just not sort of factored in. And so it's a way, like, you know, through being in education myself for all these decades, I've undergone my own education. And so the sort of stuff that you're describing just sounds amazing and breathtaking.
Oh my gosh, thank you. But I don't, like, ew, don't give me an ego when I leave here. Gross. I'm just, yeah. That's really kind of you to say. I mean, like where it came from, like where a lot of this interest in fandom started for me, was basically, you know, I grew up in a I grew up in a house of poverty. My mom was a single mom. She worked really hard, and she was a survivor of like domestic violence, and she was definitely like, you know, we lived in poverty. She didn't have a college or university education. One of the things that my mom really gave to me was a love of strong women in science fiction film and narratives. So when I was a kid, we used to watch the film Alien and Aliens until the VHS tape wore thin. And she also loved, like, you know, films like Jaws and other sort of like action films. So she instilled in me in this love for, you know, science fiction. And for me, it's interesting now working through the thesis, having published, you know, some things on science fiction and fandom, it's an honor to be here in a certain way, to not only write about women's history and their relationship with science fiction, but also in a way, you know, there's a part of me that's deeply embedded in that scholarship as well.
Yeah, and it sounds as though, as you're talking, a lot of that makes sense because you're drawing on the sort of experiences that were kind of, I suppose it's that when I was doing my degree, there was almost this sort of, in my mind, almost something very, you know, heteronormative. The idea was that effectively there was almost this sort of like objective, not so much objective truth, because that one of the great things I learned about writing essays and was always this scholar says this and that scholar says that. So, you know, this one, when you read this scholar through the lens of that scholar, then you have a synthesis of something wonderful. And that's all good, but it feels like an academic game. And a lot of the stuff we do with PhDs and vivas, it's falling, you know, it's using a set of conventions and it's a great rites of passage and so on. But there's something else, I think, that you've touched on this, which is the life story behind. Because I would have been shocked 30 years ago to imagine that somebody, you know, almost was not so much not allowed to have a backstory, but that backstory could anyway impinge on what they were doing. Because it was almost as though these books were just written because the people were so amazing and intelligent. And you wouldn't look at the social, historical, the personal context. And it would have been irrelevant. For example, you know, I heard a story of somebody doing a PhD in a different department to where I was in the University of Wales, who wanted to do something biographical and talk about her own experience of, you know, what made her do the PhD. And the supervisor was, you can't have any of that, out, get rid of it all. I put lines through it and everything. Whereas these days, you'd think, oh, that's the project. That is almost like more important or as important as the, certainly as an undergirding, as a framework for the content itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially when you're dealing with subjective narratives that are printed through, you know, not through mass media, that they're small publications, they're small distribution rates or small distribution ratios. Like, you're dealing with something that's very precious in a way. I hate to sound like I'm in total awe, but somebody cared enough to spend however many hours cutting out stencils on a mimeograph, using a hectograph in order to make, you know, like a fanzine. For me, in my own process, this again connects to my mom growing up in Long Beach. I'll never forget this. My mom was driving me to high school and I hated this high school. I was a total punk rock kid. You know, like, I didn't see the point of school. And my mom was driving me in her little beat up, like, Geo on her way to work. And she told me, oh, yeah, I found that little magazine that you made that, you know, you're handing out to your friends. And I was like, oh, my gosh, like, curse word. Like, she found my zine, you know, and it had some, you know, illicit things in it and, you know, F the system and all like all of that language and ethos that you would find in like punk subcultures. And I was just sitting there waiting to get in trouble, basically, like, you know, and my mom was just like, yeah, she told me the story when she was in the 70s, she made pamphlets to protest the school's, like, a policy with the school, the same high school that we went to. She published a pamphlet that basically protested the school's policy on women not being able to wear pants. So she wore bell bottoms across the street from her high school and handed out these pamphlets, you know, F-U-C-K, the school, like, we should wear what we want, like, you know, women shouldn't have to wear skirts and what have you. So she told me this great story and kind of was like, you know, like, see, like, this should be a bonding moment for us. Mm. But as a teenager, I was like, gross. Like, mom, you think you're so cool, you know? Inside, I felt like, oh, that is really cool. But I just, you know, did the little teenager, like, gross thing. So my mom passed about 10 years after that conversation with her. And we had, like, a, you know, we had a great relationship after I got out of those teenage years. So I also think of zines and science fiction very much as a tribute to my mom. Yeah. So
no, that's beautiful, because I'm just sort of thinking as well that there are certain stages of our lives, and I've got really young children, primary school, and of course, the, you know, even if we ourselves as adults sometimes, as parents, think that we're really cool and everything, you know, they don't see it that way at all. You know, one of them said to me, they said, Daddy, you don't look 50. I thought, oh, compliment coming. You look 100, you know. It's like, I was like, oh, yeah, right. But that's the thing, because although we often sort of turn into our own parents, even though we struggle against it, you know, as teenagers, your parents are the most sort of, you have nothing in common with your parents. When you're a bit older, you literally turn into them in terms of the sort of the things that you do. And you're like, wow, how did that happen? You know, I was like, you know, it's like the classic story of a priest who, you know, if somebody has a father or a mother who's a priest, they're often like, they're the most rebellious teenagers they could be. And guess what? A few decades later, they say, I'm going to go into the ministry. And you're like, no, that actually is almost like prohibited, you know, but all you look back and think, of course, they were rebelling against their parents. It's not as though we're all sort of fixed in time and locked in time in terms of our ideologies, views, values, and all the rest of it. But tell me a bit more about that sort of, you know, background, because so growing up in Long Beach, you mentioned the bit about watching the Alien film many times until did it run through. Did you know, sci-fi by the sound of it, and film rather than music as well, did that play a really sort of big role when you were growing up?
For sure it did. These materials were more accessible than books in my house. So books were expensive. They were ways that we just could not afford to have, like, books. We had the Bible and a couple other, like, you know, fix your house books, but I don't remember having a bookshelf until I actually moved out of my mom's house when I was a teenager. Yeah. So media was definitely a big influence, or television and film was definitely a big influence growing up. And so were libraries, strangely enough, because where we could not get, we couldn't purchase books. That was too much of a luxury. We could go to the library and check out books there. So definitely as a kid, I did all of the summer reading programs that I could. I didn't even care about the prizes at the end of it. It was just a space to go and have choice. Mm-hmm. To walk into, you know, like the children's section of a library. You're just sort of inundated with like rows and rows and shelves of books. And that if you wanted to pick out a choose your own adventure book, or if you wanted to learn about whales, or if you wanted, you know, it was just that access to me was just amazing.
And the fact you had to almost fight for it, or you had to sort of go out of your way, that it wasn't just something that fell into your lap. You actually had to be proactive and acquire these resources. That probably made a big difference. I always find that, and it's often said about children who, you know, often do really well at school because maybe they don't have the same privileges as some of their other children, and therefore it's a bit harder for them, or their trajectory is going to be a steeper one because they're not coming from a position of great privilege and wealth, and they have to really work hard and find ways of getting the education that they need. But actually not being, you know, by being fully proactive rather than just sort of almost like, oh, well, it'll all work out because I'll be bailed out by Bank of Mummy and Daddy, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and thinking about book culture too, especially we talked earlier about Christmas and how like there's almost like this tradition of giving books for Christmas or reading books during Christmas time. That was like that's been like a totally new concept for me up until like my adulthood. So libraries to me have always been, I hate to, you know, say do vocational awe, but libraries to me have often been sacred spaces, third spaces where, you know, to go in, check out interesting information. Even as a teenager, hanging out like in the music section, looking at science fiction books, reading through like Ursula K. Le Guin. And so, yeah, there it was definitely that definitely transformed my position and where I am, and it forms where I am.
Yeah. And is that something that you sort of reflect on a lot? I mean, or to put it another way, are you in touch with any of the, maybe like the teachers who you were educating? You know, do they remember you? Do you remember them? Is there a sort of a conversation going on even now with that era?
No, there's not. Yeah, they closed down my school in Galilee.
Okay, that wasn't the answer I was expecting.
Yeah, I know it, right? Yeah. Like, yeah. So, you know, they closed down my elementary school. But I find myself in this position now where I'm moving back to the States, and I served as a judge for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, which is an honor that I definitely hold very close to my heart, and like, wow, can't believe like I was able to be a part of this process. And this past year we've had close to a little bit over 100 novels that we've had to read. And as I'm moving, you know, I'm having to allocate materials and, you know, okay, all right, my friend, he's really into dystopia, so I'm going to give him this one, and, you know, kind of that stuff. So thinking through that, like in a meta way, where it's like, I'm giving away all my books and, you know, basically my apartment will be somewhat bookless, and I'm giving all of my resources to friends, to whoever want them. And, you know, like the big underscored sentiment is when you're done with it, pass it on, like keep it going, like having like a little, you know, circulation to keep access, to keep, you know,
And have you done that sort of thing for a long while? Were you doing that sort of thing when you were at school yourself? Or is that something perhaps a bit more, obviously not the Arthur C. Clarke judging, but sort of, you know, sharing resources with people and thinking this person will really benefit from this particular work. Is that something that sort of defines you?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, even though books were not really in my house and there was access, like I still was sort of like a working book snob of, you know, well, you know, the second book in the trilogy is the best one, in my opinion. You know, why are you crying? Of course, it is the second one that's the best one. So, yeah.
No, I'm just thinking, because what about the people you went to school with? Because everything you've just described is that it's, you know, it sounds as though you were just this amazingly proactive teenager, or, you know, and were the other pupils around you in any way similar, or did you sort of feel, because my sense of school sometimes is, you know, some wonderful friends and so on, but I always had a bit of a kind of more outsider sort of status, because I love that, I play on that now. Right. In other words, if I was the more sort of the sort of person who did all the sports and did all the sort of the normal things and was in with all the important people, then somehow I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that's what I found so interesting, because there are all these clusters. Like, one of my favourite films is that, you know, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
Oh, yes.
Because it gets it. It's a silly film, but utterly, utterly gets it.
Oh, for sure.
About these different things. And then what happens in the years afterwards.
Yeah.
And that people are not locked in time. So do you have any kind of connections or relationships with those childhood colleagues and peers?
I really don't. I moved around kind of a lot when I was in high school and middle school as well. So, yeah, this is like part of, this is a good marker of like growing up poor with like family, you know, issues and what have you. Not staying at one school for a long time. Going from, you know, like foster home to, you know, somebody, grandma's home to in all different cities, like in Long Beach and outside of Los Angeles as well. Romy and Michelle, I really love that movie, not only for the way that like the aesthetics of the film and how, but also the fact that like it is very much outsider culture. Like when she says like, I'm the creator of Post-it notes. It's like, hello, like I totally get this. Yeah. I think outsider culture too, for me, was mostly a lot of Southern California punk culture where we're sort of like a nomadic sort of group where, you know, okay, somebody's living here now, somebody's moving on to here, you know, like we're kind of like a hard group to pin down in a certain way.
No, it sounds as though the experiences that you sort of built up are, I mean, my journey was opposite, you see, because whatever you said, it sounds so character defining, because I kind of feel that maybe I'm doing those sort of, that sort of networking and that sort of, you know, just, I suppose one of the things I enjoy about being on campus here so often is because you just sort of get to, and not least for doing these interviews, meet such a diverse range of people. Mm-hmm. Well, I say diverse range because often these are people who work within an academic setting, but not all of the people I interview are part of that setting. Mm. And so I kind of feel that there's just so many opportunities to learn about what makes people tick. And they're not always, you know, what their second monograph was, sort of thing. Right. You know, there's all these other antecedents and it's just what you're outlining. But it sounds as though, I mean, so in my case, I kind of feel I didn't live very much. You know, I kind of feel when I was younger, I kind of felt that I came to university without a huge amount of life experience. Not that my parents were very rich, they certainly weren't. But I, you know, kind of, I wasn't the person who ever went out. I never went to parties. I just sort of came home, did my homework, watched television with my parents. Right. That's all great. But sort of looking, you know, now I kind of feel I'm starting to do things by those standards a little bit more adventurous.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's like, you know, I feel like there's, for a lot of folks, like there is that time period where it's like, okay, now is my time to be rebellious. Now is my time to go to the movies, buy a giant bucket of popcorn and see if I can eat this while watching the French film Raw, which is about cannibalism. That didn't work for me. I don't know if you had similar feels. But I think that like that period of exploration and rebelliousness and pushing against, it comes at different times. For a lot of folks, like, oh yeah, there's youth. We're going to read Hermann Hesse. We're going to look at like youth cultures and what have you. Some folks don't have like the opportunity to fail really hard, you know, and to go through those experiences of danger and destruction and, you know, chaos. So in a way, it's kind of great that you get to explore a rebellious side now, like in your, you know.
Now that I've turned 50. And actually, I think you're right, because people I went to school with, in some cases, were rebels. You know, the people who were like, wow, look at that person there. They're getting in trouble. They know they're going to get detention. They know they might even be expelled. You know, you just know that they're on that precipice. And you're thinking, God, that's like a different world to the one I inhabit. But now those same people are 40s and 50s now.
Right.
And they're actually kind of, you know, they've had their rebellion. So they lead kind of perfectly respectable middle or whatever class lives and kind of, you know, live a life of some conformity. So they had this. So I remember them at school when they were the rebels.
Yeah.
But now, of course, they're kind of very sort of like conservative with a small C. Whereas I mean, by different sort of standards, I'm not quite at the stage where I would start doing any sort of anything terribly illegal or anything. But it's just so curious to me that it's almost as though I'm the one now who, you know, when I leave work of an evening, I'm not the one who sort of goes home and, what you know, does sort of conventional things. I sort of have all these other things to do, you know, the cinema or whatever it might be. But kind of almost, but I never did that when I was young. I never went to the cinema. I did a PhD looking at film, and I'd only sort of got into film while an undergraduate student. So suddenly it was like I was discovering things in my late teens, early 20s, whereas a lot of people were like, oh, we saw that 10 years ago. And I'm like, 10 years ago? I don't even think I knew what a cinema was. So it's funny how we all sort of find the right way for ourselves.
Right.
And at different points on the journey, or the different points on the sort of on the curve, then we kind of, when it's ready, right for us, we hop along, but we don't all do it uniformly. And thank goodness we don't. Otherwise, we'd all be, you know, automata.
Yeah. I never pegged you, though, as like somebody who was, you know, like very conformist and, you know, straight laced, so to say, because like you wear a leather jacket on campus. Yeah. Like that is a statement piece.
But I never did until about 3-4 years ago. I'd be wearing a tie. and a long sleeve shirt almost every day.
I love this transition for you. This is amazing.
But I still feel uncomfortable doing it, in the sense that it's sort of me but not me. Maybe it's always been me, but it was a part of me that was so deeply suppressed that, you know, I would think that if I didn't wear a tie, the reason for that was actually because when I started teaching, I wasn't that much older than the student. So it was my way of almost like demarcating myself.
Which is important.
Which is really important, because it's almost like if I walk into the room, there needs to be some sense in which I'm the person who's going to be delivering the material. Otherwise, you know, obviously it's sort of like those boundaries will be really unclear. So I needed to do that, and professionally, in order to sort of earn my spurs, as it were. And I think there suddenly came a point, and it was probably sort of late 40s, when I suddenly sort of thought, well, hang on, that way of doing things was perhaps a way of appeasing a different generation who've now left. Now, that may have been unconscious, but it might have been, oh, I better wear a tie, because the person who gave me the job wears a tie.
Mm.
But now that I'm probably the age of the students' parents rather than the students themselves, something has to change. So it's interesting that, you know, I never wore leather jackets when I was a teenager, but now I do wear them. But it was something that somehow I started doing just at an age when other people around my age, in some cases, have perhaps become a little bit more conformist and not as into their appearance perhaps as they might have been when they were younger. So I'm always doing things a little bit back to front.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like, what does a teacher look like? What, you know, and the how do you allocate power visually, you know, like in a classroom setting? I think it's a little bit easier for PGRs because the students in the classroom have a tendency to know that we're tired and very underpaid, if paid at all. So I feel like being more rebellious, we can get away with a little bit more.
Yeah, no, and it. But again, when I was a student, if I saw one of my lecturers in the supermarket shopping, that felt weird because it was like, hang on, that person belongs in a room where they have a sheet of notes,
right?
And they have all these publications, and we hear them talking about their publications. They're very erudite people. They can't do the sort of things that I do, like going to the shops, because they inhabit a different space. So there really was this them and us. There was this, it felt, and it's a perception. But also, I was 18 at the time. Now I'm the age that those tutors were when I was a student. So again, seeing a lecturer shop in the supermarket felt weird. It felt almost wrong, and it would have been very wrong to go up to them and start a conversation, precisely because they inhabited a different sort of space. Whereas what I have now done in more recent years is try to redress that. But I don't think that would have been the right thing to do even a decade or two ago. But it feels now, and maybe it's just that I'm more comfortable, I've almost like earned my spurs, as the saying goes.
Right.
And the interesting thing, and I'd be interested to hear your perception on this, is that I don't feel that it's impacted on people's sort of sense of Chris's status. Because if it did, I would be very worried about that. But it doesn't seem to have done that. And that's interesting. And of course, I wear it carefully, you know, in the sense I might wear it when I'm going, you know, on campus. But if I'm teaching, I certainly wouldn't do it, you know, while wearing that jacket. But what's your sense on that in terms of the relationship between the lecturer and the professor, shall we say? The student, sorry, the lecturer. Yeah.
So I'm going to go back again to when I was an undergraduate at the University of Iowa. I was a cleaner. So I worked in an elementary school, primary school that had about 600 kids, and they all knew me as Mrs. Katie. So whenever I went out into public, I would normally run into one of the, you know, students. And, you know, one of the things that, like, you know, we're talking 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, one of the first things that they would do is when they would see me at the grocery store or wherever, is that they'd point and then they yell very loud, "Oh my gosh, it's Miss Katie." So like, there's sort of like a weird fanfare around it where it's like, you know, like, what are you doing here? You're outside of your space. Where's your mop bucket? You know, like, you shop at this one of the three grocery stores, you know, too. And it was really sweet and comforting for me, because I had the same sort of fanfare when I'd run into my professors at UIowa. Like, you know, I do remember pointing at one of my Shakespeare professors at the at a restaurant he was eating at with his daughter, and I was like, oh my God. And he caught me because it was just like, oh my gosh, you eat Mexican food too? You know, so that was a way to sort of like help me work through those small communities and like the surveillance of it, which small communities, you know, often have like an aspect of high surveillance of, oh, I saw so-and-so go down to the store. This is what they bought. You know, that sort of communication which would be shared freely amongst people. Yeah. So,
yeah, because what you've said has just made me reflect, because I think that when I was a student and when I started out in this profession, there were probably sort of like go-to figures, authority figures, people who I sort of perceived as the sort of people I wanted to emulate. If I wanted to work in this profession, they were the people I had to sort of almost sort of, you know, not suck up to, but sort of it was almost as though they were the people who kind of represented and did what I wanted to accomplish. So that was all great. However, sometimes I think, well, I do things very differently because they, in those days, sort of issues around pastoral welfare, student support, didn't really factor in. I made that my own. So from when I came here, even at University of Kent, being senior tutor, looking after student interests is something that I organically did. It wasn't that I thought, oh, well, I'll do this because no one else wanted to do it. It was more like, that's the dream job. Right. A lot of people were like, oh, the dream job is to be director of research. And I'd be thinking, no, because actually, what about the students whose needs have to be met? You know, and I have to do that research, I have to do the teaching, but actually, you know, I know how important it is to have those one-to-one interactions. So I think that there was a point when I was still working with, and maybe even had as line manager, some of these staff, but they were sometimes sort of like thinking, oh God, you know, rather you than me kind of thing. And I thought, that's interesting. So I started to carve my own niche. And I think that when those particular colleagues then retired, or in some cases passed away, you know, suddenly I thought, hang on a minute, do I just carry on as if they were still here when I've already almost like shown that that model might have worked for a different generation but doesn't work now? Or do I become a more distinctive Chris DC rather than the Chris DC who's just doing what somebody else did and which I'm not even sure is necessarily the way I want to do things? So it's interesting that that shift happened, but it happened well into my academic career.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I was thinking through as you were sharing your experience with me is the role of really good mentorship. And I think that's where I've been incredibly privileged to have some truly amazing folks like as mentors, who I consider mentors, whether they know that they're mentors or not. So I think of, you know, sort of the informal chats that I've had about science fiction with Dr. Andrew M. Butler, who is editor of Extrapolation, who has edited numerous collections, who has published on, you know, Philip K. Dick and Terry Pratchett, and just, you know, this amazing person. I think of Paul March Russell, who is, you know, again, like editor of a major science fiction, you know, journal, who publishes modernism and science fiction. And I think about some of my librarian mentors as well, Jennifer Burke Pierce, who has published on libraries and youth and fandom. And so I've been incredibly privileged to have mentors who, you know, are there for me in, you know, in pastoral ways and also ways where they challenge me to think differently. They challenge me to think through about like what my work is doing. What do I have to contribute to the field of science fiction and fan studies? So it not only helps me grow as a scholar, right? But it also helps me to work on unpacking, you know, why I love science fiction so much, what you know, my experience of science fiction, my experience of access to these materials. So not only growing like as a scholar, but also growing deeper into being human.
And do you think that the nature of scholarship is something that is changing, needs to change? Are you shaping that narrative? Do you feel that, in terms of, you know, that word outputs or impact right. comes up a lot in this profession, but do you see the objective, you know, to have an amazing monograph based on your PhD, or is there more to it? Is it about the dissemination, the teaching? Is it about maybe reaching some of those people like your younger self who perhaps didn't fit into a sort of a privileged paradigm? Right. Is that kind of where you see yourself headed?
Yeah. So where I see myself headed, like with the thesis, is the whole reason why I pursued this thesis was there was a lot of abuse and harassment and violence for women in science fiction fan spaces. Video gaming is another big one of those spaces. And some of the critics were first to say, well, you know, women don't belong in science fiction fandom. You know, they've never been here before and they don't deserve to be here. It's a man's game. So at the very least, you know, I want my research to be accessible to, you know, young women, 13, 14, 15, you know, other women, older women as well, that when they are getting, you know, when there's forms of bullying or violence or what have you, it's like, no, actually, like, here's the history of where, you know, women in science fiction is. This is what, you know, this is our connection. This is like sort of a kin to us. And we do deserve to be here, and we do deserve to love our media, critique our media, and, you know, create and engage with it.
Yeah.
I think teaching and scholarship to me is always so much deeply embedded in autobiographical work, how you approach teaching, your writing lesson plans, the way that, you know, like you perform it in the classroom, providing forms of engagement, doing small groups, working through accessibility and all this stuff. I think that a lot of times it is informed by your own experience in the world where, you know, maybe you know what it was like to find a space, you know, that was inaccessible, or that you felt left out, or that, you know, the seating arrangements, you're next to a real jerk and what have you, and now you have to be in a small group. Yeah. And, you know, so I think that informs teaching. And I think that scholarship is a little bit harder to scratch and uncover, to look at the autobiographical aspect of it, because there's like this kind of terrible objective-y thing that, you know, that we have to footnote and cite, and that there is this harshness to it.
Yeah, and you touched on something I think really seminal here, which is that the model of education, certainly that I grew up with, was the one of almost like conformity. It was sit in a room, be quiet, listen to the teacher, put your hand up, or you might be asked a question and answer that respectfully. If you don't know the answer, everyone will, you know, then you'll be told off because you haven't done your homework. So there's almost that expectation that everyone was sort of, you know, that issues around special needs, issues around disability, kind of never factored in. It was more the case that if you didn't conform, then you were a problem child.
Right.
And a lot of people conformed and a lot of people didn't or couldn't. And they were the ones who were, you know, seen to be, you know, educationally, you know, substandard. And I think, thank goodness, that education has evolved over the years. But it sounds like in talking to you there that you're very aware and maybe have even been a beneficiary of some of those sort of those spaces that maybe just weren't available in decades past.
Yeah. So one thing that I wanted to mention, that sort of like, you know, I love when people, you know, give advice and who haven't actually lived the experience, who doesn't have any kids, I give great parenting advice. Ha ha ha. Yeah. But when I was finishing my English literature degree, I actually had a project. It was a community-centered project where I worked at an elementary school with children who the majority of them lived in low socioeconomic standard. And the school that I worked at had a really bad management style of, it's like a no tolerance zone. You hit somebody and you're suspended from, and this was obviously targeted for, you know, BIPOC and POC children, poor children as well. So I created a zine workshop for students in their fifth year about ways of articulating power and resistance to authority figures. And I set up a fake scenario where I had basically lost some of their work, quote unquote, lost some of their work, that they had worked really hard on this work. But I'm an adult and it doesn't matter. You can't hold me accountable. Lots of the students in this school felt like there wasn't a sort of like accountability with their teachers, with their, you know, like with adults in their life. So these kids wrote like, you know, really passionate zines, like, how dare you flush my painting down the toilet, you know, Miss Katie, like, you know, it's okay. Adults can make mistakes too, but, you know, so I was working on giving them a language to, you know, to put resist that. And I think that's one example of the ways that, like, I've been fortunate to take teaching, scholarship, and sort of autobiographical and combine that all together. And that's like the work that I love to do. I love workshops and making fanzines with folks. And yeah.
Yeah. So that sounds as though you've got a lot that you can and indeed are, you know, continuing to offer. I've got just a couple more questions to ask you. One is, because obviously we're talking about nostalgia, but the whole thing about negative experiences, and I think you've kind of answered this, but I was asked the question, you know, is it possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? And how would you answer that in the context of your own sort of life situation? Because it sounds as though there's a lot not to be nostalgic about, but actually you've survived and you've overcome and you've actually, you know, done some incredible things, not least, you know, as you just outlined, that you couldn't, I'm guessing, have possibly imagined that you'd have been doing all those years ago.
Yeah. Negative nostalgia. I like this. This is a really interesting concept to think through. I think it can often be perhaps like a way to reinforce that, like, you're a baddie, that, you know, that you've lived through some tough stuff, and that, like, whatever comes your way, obviously it can't be as tough as XYZ experience. But yeah, that's a really interesting concept to think through, because is that a form of, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. But what do you think your younger self would have imagined? So that you know, young, you know, teenager in Long Island, Long Beach.
Long Beach. I wasn't going to correct you, but I was like, it's okay. There is a Long Beach in New Jersey, though. Yeah.
But growing up in California, do you think, A, you could imagine what you're doing now, but B, you know, what did you think that you might end up doing?
Oh my gosh. I thought I'd be dead by 25. Yeah, I really did. Yeah. Sorry. So like the fact that I survived 25. Yeah. So no, I mean, like, that's, sorry for that to be so shocking. No. But living in harsh times. It's only positive.
It sounds it, because you know, literally the only way is up, as a famous philosopher once said. And I've got one more question for you, Kate, which is whether you'd consider yourself to be a looking back or looking forward kind of person.
That's a really, because I'm not a now moment person. I'm not. I do like to plan. I do like the way of, like, futures and speculation and that sort of stuff, where but I also see where speculating futures is so rooted in nostalgia and my understanding of, you know, like, things that were comforting, things that I felt were familiar. I don't know. This is really juicy. This is something that I want to think through.
Well, it is. And also, of course, I'm somebody who likes to deconstruct binaries in all my work.
Yeah.
And yet I ask that really binary-driven question. I suppose it's almost to be deliberately provocative.
Right.
Because it's like, ooh, you know, it's like you have to make an answer, but actually it's okay not to feel that you have to choose one or the other, because life is full of all sorts of heterogeneous experiences. We don't all do things in a uniform way. You know, you can look back and look forward. Mm-hmm. It's when sometimes you do something maybe at the expense of the other a little bit too often that it can be perhaps a little bit counterintuitive or counterproductive.
I have recently returned to Ursula K. Le Guin's The Carrier Bag of Fiction essay. And one of the things that I think is most beautiful about this essay, there's so many beautiful things about this essay, is how she can simultaneously look back and look forward in a way that is really wonderful and hopeful, where, you know, she talks about how, you know, prehistoric folks only worked 15 hours a week. They collected handfuls of oats and nuts and berries, and wouldn't be good to save something for the future, you know. And then at the end of the essay, you know, she brings it back to where she's basically saying, like, yeah, in our now position, and in the future, like, we should be doing similar things, like looking at newts and gathering flowers and, you know, not necessarily quote unquote returning to nature, but yeah, like exploring that sort of leisure and pleasure and time of just being in a way that it's also rooted in nostalgia. So,
Kate, so many nuggets there, so many wonderful insights. That has been amazing. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you so much for having me.